Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio...
It's always the people who send their kids to exclusive prep schools that cost $30,000 a year who ask me if you can really solve these problems by throwing money at them. And I always say, yes, that's a great way to do it. Rich people who spend thousands of dollars on their children's education always look at me and say, Jonathan, is money really the answer? I always say, well, if it works for your kid, I think it's a good answer for the poorest children in the Bronx.
In mid-April, hundreds of Massachusetts high school students refused to take state-mandated proficiency exams, preferring to risk failure or even suspension rather than submit to what they felt was increasingly irrelevant and subjective testing. Meanwhile, New York and other major cities look vainly for qualified educators to administer their crumbling school systems, and in states like California, new prisons far outnumber universities. Added to that are a new generation of laws like California's Proposition 21, which criminalizes numerous youth activities under the guise of combating gangs. It's no wonder juvenile prison populations are on the rise. Displaying a crass disbelief in the capabilities of American youth, President Clinton recently expressed his support for the so-called school-to-work program, a state-based initiative that places high school students who seemingly show little aptitude for higher learning into service sector career paths. Whatever happened to equal opportunity? Sometimes it seems the only child Americans care about anymore is Elian Gonzalez. Providing a welcome change from this negativity is Jonathan Kozol, who, in a new book titled Ordinary Resurrections, explores some of the issues facing American education from a unique perspective. Kozol won renown for his work in previous books Amazing Grace and Savage Inequalities, which expose and indict the failings of inner-city public schools while still managing to portray the remarkably hopeful and vibrant lives of the children who attend them. Ordinary Resurrections brings Kozol back to the Harlem public schools he wrote of in Amazing Grace, but with far more personal intimacy than the often polemical tone of his previous work. To solve the educational problems of this nation, Kozol demands that we look towards children. His new book, Ordinary Resurrections, leads the way. In this interview with Ben Wright, Jonathan Kozol explains why he chose to write such a hopeful and energized book in a time when the American education system crumbles around us. In doing so, he responds to the issues of mandatory standardized testing and school-to-work programs that, he says, are typical examples of our society's loss of respect for children.
I'd like to start out, if we could, just talking a bit about the book before we go deeper into some of the issues of education. Unlike your earlier books, and certainly more than Amazing Grace, this book is really a collection of stories, sometimes about some of the more mundane details of these children's lives in the South Bronx. And I'm wondering, why did you write this book? Why is it important for us to read?
I think a good deal of the writing and press attention given to inner-city kids, particularly black and Hispanic kids in the United States, tends to get stuck in the kingdom of labels in which our presuppositions about the types of kids we're talking about blind us to the actual details of their lives. There's a tendency to look at inner-city kids and to almost force them to carry heavy weights of sociological labels, like the fashionable one of recent years, predator, or amongst those who really seem to have a low opinion of inner-city children, super predator. They're described often as though they weren't really children, but premature adults or precocious criminals. We put these labels on them, and then if our research grant gets renewed, we come back 5 years later with a new label. And this whole industry of thinking up ways to categorize and slot urban children is very profitable for academic experts. Think tanks create entire empires out of thinking up new labels for children they basically dislike. I think it's a great mistake to do this. And I decided for the first time in my career to spend a lot of time with children without any prior agenda, without any presuppositions, without slotting them in any particular category. I just wanted to listen to them. I wanted to be with them and have fun with them and share the details of their lives. Now, all writers know it's very hard to do this if you have a pre-established outline for a book, if you're going to a neighborhood to get confirmation of particular ideas. It's very tough to do this, and most journalists have to do that, because when they go to a neighborhood, they're going there to get a story, and it's a specific story which has been determined in advance. I decided for the first time in my life I didn't want to have that kind of pressure on me. Going always to get a story means that you listen to kids ever eager for the sentences which will support your agenda. I hate having to do that. The trouble with that is that anything that children say that's truly whimsical and unpredictable becomes wasted time. You're thinking, well, I can't use that. And I've seen reporters from very respectable newspapers make that clear with kids by looking terribly bored suddenly when the kid isn't giving them what they wanted to get. Mm-hmm. And then they will steer the child back into the area they were assigned. They'll say, let's go back to what you said before. And they're like, it's like they're shepherding the kids back into the area of pay dirt that will give them what their editor wanted. Mm-hmm. I hate doing that. A nun said to me there is a difference between getting and receiving. I wanted to leave a lot of time in which I didn't have to get anything. And as a result, I received much more beautiful and unexpected stuff than I've ever heard before. I think the difference here is that I spent a lot of time listening to these little ones. There's a chapter I call The Details of Life. And, you know, I often think that we waste so much time thinking in large categories and big words like despair, resilience, or whatever other terms we use. We sort of forget that most of life for children, as for most grown-ups, is made up of tiny little particles of joy or happiness. In the case of the little kids, it's things like licorice sticks and lighted yo-yos, which were in fashion while I was in the neighborhood, and maddening little computer toys that would squeak when they were in their pockets, little plastic butterflies, little translucent butterflies that the little girls put in their hair, and these are the things they actually talk about. I'm a political person, and I hope we'll get to that. And this book does clearly have a political agenda, but I mean, which was sort of superimposed on the book while I was editing it, while I was drawing conclusions. But when you're with these little kids like Pineapple and Elio, Pineapple's a little 8-year-old book, and Elio's a 7-year-old. When you're with these kids, you're not thinking of big ideas like racial segregation or gross injustice. You're thinking of Winnie the Pooh or whatever book a child has just shown you. You're dealing with the little details of their lives, and they dominate this book.
In a way, it seems because this book concentrates really on the children's reality, and in many cases on the hopeful side of that, that perhaps you are now putting your stock in different things than you did back in the day when you wrote Death at an Early Age. Are you still fighting the political battle? And do you see hope in the political battle to make schools more equal?
If there's one difference now, in my point of view from before, it's certainly that I pay far more attention to the role of religion in the lives of children. I think political activists and liberals in America made a great mistake by avoiding this issue for so long. There was often a sense among white liberals, at least, that they shouldn't talk about religion And as a result, I think they left a vacuum, which has been filled by right-wing forces, some of the extreme right-wing Christian groups, which exploit the gospel in order to trample on the gospel. I think this is our fault. I think many of us on the liberal and left side of the spectrum created that vacuum and basically left it to extremists on the right to appropriate the Bible. And I do feel now, if there's one thing I've learned from these years in the South Bronx, it's that religion is central to the lives and the moral strength of an awful lot of these families that I know. And I think those of us who are involved in social struggle and political struggle have to repossess the Bible and say it's our Bible too, and this is what it stands for. So that's a difference. But in all other respects, my political struggles are unchanged. As recently as last week, I was in Washington talking with some members of the United States Senate who have known me for many years about the gross, unacceptable inequalities of public school finance in America. I hammer at that issue. That has never changed. I still find it shameful that we have largely turned our back on the whole question of apartheid and no longer talk about residential segregation. Some days when I'm in the South Bronx, when I'm with the kids, in a quiet moment, when I'm by myself, I'll just look around me and I'll think, my God, not a white child in sight, 99.8% segregated. And I think is this what Dr. King and all our martyrs died for? So that anger has not changed a bit. I still am fighting the issue of school inequality on the most practical political levels that I can, supporting groups who are bringing court suit against several states, including the state of New York, to demand equal education for the poorest children of color. The kids I describe in the South Bronx, these little kids like Elio and Pineapple, get in reality about $5,000 a year spent on their public education. These are kids in regular third grades in the South Bronx. The New York Times sometimes says it's about 8,000, but in fact, head of the school system in New York told me at dinner a few years ago that those numbers are skewed and that what really gets down to a child in the third grade is about $5,000. That's what we're spending on a little boy like Elio, the poorest of the poor, in physically one of the most unhealthy ghettos of America. You lift Elio up in your arms and you plunk him down in a beautiful, wealthy white suburb of New York City out on Long Island, one of the wealthiest suburbs, and he'd be getting nearly $20,000 spent on his public education every year. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know anybody, Christian, Jewish, or any other religion, who can look at that and find that acceptable. All religions say when people assemble in church or synagogue that all children are equal in the eyes of God, but they're not equal in the eyes of New York State or the eyes of the United States. They have price tags on their foreheads. Elio is priced as a $5,000 baby, and if we want to see a $20,000 baby, we have to go out to the suburbs. That, to me, is abhorrent, morally unacceptable, and theologically offensive.
This is Bruderhof Radio. If you've got questions or comments about today's program, call us toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. That's 1-800-778-8461. You're listening to Jonathan Kozol on Bruderhof Radio. Kozol recently spoke with Ben Wright about the so-called school-to-work program, which places high school students in service sector career paths, often denying them the opportunity for a college education. Kozol also commented on standardized testing, which is quickly becoming a bone of contention between students, teachers, and school administrators across the country.
It's interesting you mention putting a price tag on children's heads. It reminds me of something you say in your book in referral to the program Clinton's been supporting lately called School to Work.
Oh, I hate that program.
And you mentioned the name of a girl, Pineapple, who you said changed her career in her mind 6 or 7 times in the span of a few years. How is this program and other programs like it narrowing the opportunities for these kids and reducing their opportunities for higher learning and career?
School to Work, which is usually hyphenated, is highly specific to class and race. It's a targeted agenda. They are now bringing into public school at the level of 6th, 7th, and 8th grades, middle school. The school systems are now introducing the idea that students ought to choose for a career at that level. And so when they leave elementary school in 5th grade and they pick a middle school, they had to pick the school which specializes in the career that they have chosen, whether it's computers or medical services or whatever. None of these schools, or very few of them in the South Bronx, get kids into high schools, which will ever get them into college. So when they choose these career schools, they're not really choosing to enter any of these careers at a high level. I noticed that school officials now use the word train when they're speaking of inner-city kids. They never use that word when they speak of their own children. They speak of educating their children. Nobody trains the daughter of a President of the United States for entry-level labor. We educate her, and she's a lovely child. She deserves it. We educate her to go on to inherit the earth, and Pineapple deserves the same thing. The kids in the South Bronx deserve the same thing. I also think it's an atrocity to look at any youngsters and tell them to choose a career when they're 13 or 14 years old. That's crazy. I didn't know what I wanted to be when I was 21 years old. When I left Harvard, I was probably 22 then. I had the slightest idea what I wanted to do in the world. I didn't even know when I was 28. I changed my goals repeatedly in life. Most of the people I find most interesting, like Thomas Merton or Dorothy Day, are people who had no idea what they wanted to do when they were young, nor did St. Francis, for that matter. All the people who have enriched our world, transformed our vision of life, seem to me to be wanderers, people who leave a lot of time before they settle on a narrow slot in which they're going to take their stand in life. And I wish we could give the same freedom to these little kids that I know. You know, God help us if Toni Morrison or Langston Hughes or Martin Luther King had been told at the age of 12, hey, kid, it's time for you to choose a career. We're going to train you for something useful because we know you're not going to college. How impoverished would America be if we had done that? It would have been a sin then, and it's a sin now. It's rotten, and it shouldn't be done. It ought to be stopped.
Another aspect, I think, of this reducing children's lives to one career is narrowing them down academically through academic standards. Talk a bit about these academic standards, state testing, and what is that doing to these children?
There's nothing wrong with standards in general. I'm not a completely romantic, dewy-eyed liberal, even though I did come of age politically in the 1960s, and even though people like Thoreau are my heroes. I'll be quite honest, some liberals I've known are naive about this. You can't ignore the exams. They're there. They're a reality. Kids have to pass exams to survive in America. And God knows I had to pass a lot of exams to get into Harvard, and probably quite a few to get out. So those of us who have already benefited from succeeding in the competition of that is endemic to life in the United States cannot scorn it for children of low income. We've got to strengthen them so they can enter this competition and win it. In that respect, I'm not against standards and I'm not against exams. And if rich kids are getting expensive private preparation for the SATs, which, as we know, wealthy people do in New York, their parents buy them an unfair advantage by giving them private programs such as Princeton Review, which are very expensive, to enable them to hit the exams. If rich kids get it, we ought to be providing that for poor kids too. So in that sense, I try to be realistic. I want the little kids I know to get into medical school. If they want to be pediatricians, then I want them to have that chance. At the same time, there is something crazy, obsessive, and unhealthy about the way the standards movement is being enforced. We are making these long lists of specific areas of knowledge, specific content areas that every child must know by the second month of the second grade or the fourth month of the third grade. Little tiny particles of amputated knowledge, a little fact that some alleged expert at a university in some city decides ought to be on the list. And so basically what's happening is that old people are summarizing all the things they learned in school and figuring, well, it was good for me, so we'll damn well make every inner city kid memorize this stuff too, and then we'll drill them to death for the exams. And there's something crazy about it. First of all, they keep making up new lists of standards, and they enumerate them tirelessly. They'll say there are 85 proficiencies that every third grader must know, and if she doesn't know it, she's not going to be promoted. And next year they'll have another meeting paid for by some right-wing foundation, and they'll say, no, now it's going to be 122 proficiencies, and they'll list them. I have to tell you that it reminds me of the lists that psychotics make. There's something obsessive-compulsive about it. There's something bizarre about this sort of numerical fascination where these experts, most of whom don't know any children, are just sort of using up scarce funds to list everything in the world they can think of to make life miserable for teachers and to terrify children before the next exam. The fact of the matter is that equal standards for all children in America are a good idea, but to impose standards of equality without schools of equality is purely punitive. It is just a way of humiliating children whom we have denied the possibility to acquire these skills in advance. A society, a nation which really wanted to raise the standards of education for all children would not begin with the exam. We would restore art and music programs because those are very good ways of stimulating children in general, even though they have no direct payoff on a reading test. We would broaden the curriculum. We would pour in the money. Rich people who spend thousands of dollars on their children's education always look at me and say, Jonathan, is money really the answer? I always say, well, if it works for your kid, I think it's a good answer for the poorest children in the Bronx. It's always the people who send their kids to exclusive prep schools that cost $30,000 a year who ask me if you can really solve these problems by throwing money at them. And I always say, yes, that's a great way to do it. I would pour money into these schools. I would divide the class size in half. I would make sure every child has access to a terrific library with a good certified librarian. I would make sure all these children have the same range of curriculum as they enter secondary school that rich kids have, including wonderful science labs and all the advanced placement courses in literature and foreign languages that rich kids take for granted. I'd do all of that for 10 years or 16 years, and then I would raise the standards. But to raise the standards first is brutal.
I just wanted to ask you about one thing. And that is that it has struck me as ironic that a number of the school shootings we've seen in recent years took place in very affluent neighborhoods.
That's right, in white neighborhoods largely.
Right. And I was just wondering, what's your take on that? How does that reflect on maybe a moral bankruptcy where these inner city kids are very different from the rich kids in that sense.
Well, I try to be very careful not to fall into stereotypes about inner city kids. I hate the tendency to say, you know, that they have some kind of criminal predisposition, because I know that's pure racist hogwash. But I like to be careful not taking the opposite position and saying, oh, you know, the ethical destitution is out in the rich suburbs. I think we have to be careful about categorizing either wealthy or poor children, or white children, or black or brown children. Mm-hmm. I just think all these categories are wrong. In fact, there has not been any dramatic increase in crime amongst young people in the United States in recent years, despite the handful of dramatic incidents which have captured news attention. I mean, all the little children I see are, by and large, as innocent as the kids that I grew up with in the 1940s in a nice little town outside of Boston. They have the same kind of sense of humor. They're very much. I taught inner city kids in Roxbury, that's the black community of Boston, when I was a young teacher. For 1 year, I ran freedom schools in the black community, and I also taught in a wealthy suburb of Boston, known as Newton, Massachusetts, in the years when there was a liberal voluntary busing program. So I taught integrated classrooms in a wealthy suburb. And now I see these kids in the South Bronx, and I still visit affluent schools now and then. I don't think that most of the distinctions we make about these children hold water in any way at all. They have the same kinds of dreams, the same kind of delicious unpredictability. They're just kids, surprisingly sweet and beautiful children, surprisingly from the point of view of those who read too much sociology and don't know anything about them.
You've been listening to Jonathan Kozol on Bruderhof Radio. His latest book is called Ordinary Resurrections and will be published by Crown Publishing in late April. Bruderhof Radio is produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. For further information or to order tapes and transcripts of Bruderhof Radio, call us toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information, call 1-800-778-8461.